laptops, thumb drives, and a wall charger. A sure sign that our nerd is here again. And now, with a quest of enriching your experience with computers, here's Benjamin Rockwell with Computer Talk Radio.
There's plenty in store for you this week here on Computer Talk Radio. Just in this hour, Allison, she's got a question. How do digital forensics teams recover data from drives? Keith McDonald, he's going to give some reflection on the ups and downs of Apple leasing plans. And Marty's going to be talking about the various AI platforms. The website, of course, computertalkradio.com, computertalkradio.com. The phone number, 888-NERD, 888, that's 888-6373-888. For the website, you can scroll down to where it says contact us today. If you phone me, you can also leave a message. I will get back to you either way with answers to your computer questions, your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Let's dive into the news. And one of the big things that has come up since the advent of smartphones is the idea of banning them in schools. And this has been moving forward across the country and around the world. Now, while it was more controversial a few years back, public opinion has been shifting, and it's been pretty hard across all ages. Pew Research Center has run a survey, and they've done this a number of times over the years. And the latest numbers are that just over three quarters of U.S. adults are on board with banning middle school, high school students from using cell phones anytime during class. One of the concepts is bell to bell, the opening bell to the closing bell, no cell phones. You know, there are plenty of distractions. There's issues with screen time. There's a lot of other drawbacks with the extended usage of smartphones that really support this idea. So many youth are in need of the focus on learning and being educated, and teachers have to do something. So do the schools. And that's why these bans have popped up. Now, I get that there are complaints by teenagers who are addicted to the screens and all of that. But this is about becoming adults. Everything we deal with in school, whether we're talking about elementary, middle school, high school, even into college, is all about growing minds, allowing these youth to become adults, and really controlling and tempering any kind of temptation to avoid responsibility. So yes, I'm on board with this. I don't know that I was always on board. I felt early on it was an experiment, you know, maybe not in the school my son was in, but now I've really grown more towards this idea of everybody's doing it and they're seeing just dramatic success with this. So definitely a route to go. Now, SpaceX, just about 45 days ago, they had their IPO. And days later, they hit over $200 a share. Now, that initial bump of the IPO pushed Elon Musk into what I would call healthy trillionaire status for, well, a short while. In the ensuing weeks, even though SpaceX has had decent successes and lots of press, although some of the press has been negative press, it has dropped down to about $112 per share by the middle of the week, this past week. And that is something that, well, you know, it's going to take a journey. It's lower than what they initially offered it for, and then it shot up from there. Now, this journey cut Elon Musk's wealth about in half to a paltry $700 billion. Elon really doesn't seem to be aware, well, concerned by it, I guess. He posted on X with a note of, And I quote this, parentheses, former, end parentheses, trillionaire. So I think he's showing here that he does have a sense of humor. He could afford to. $700 billion. He still has roughly twice as much as the number two person in the Forbes 500 list. So still, while SpaceX was a brief attention getter for the stock price, it also bears to reason that there is a good amount of long-term value given their ventures in space, a lot of the things that they are coming up with to allow us to do things like, whatever it is. I think we're up to 20 or so visits to the International Space Station, and the Starliner is going to try their next run at it, perhaps later this year. Time will tell. And Elon isn't really hurting. He's got enough money there to continue many different quests. So I'm not too concerned about him. The CEO of Microsoft, Satya Nadella, provided some interest this week in the AI space. He was asked on CNN this past Sunday if we are in an AI bubble. His response was that unless AI produces broad economy-wide growth, that, quote, we're not going to have this movie end well. And he's kind of right there. He also admitted somewhere else that Microsoft is so short on compute cycles that Copilot is being served up before the customers of Azure. Now, this didn't seem to impact stocks too badly, as Microsoft also announced earnings up 18% to $90 billion in the last quarter. That news, however, is only a picture of a single piece in the puzzle, a journey that involves many others and can extend across many years ahead. It shows what he is thinking, though, which, as a leader in the AI space, is something that we all need to be paying attention to. We need to be thinking about, where is AI going? What is it going to provide us? How is it going to affect us, and all of the rest of that? Also, from the Microsoft front, at a very odd time, considering the pricing for RAM, Microsoft raised the minimum and recommended system requirements for the first time in 17 years. The new requirement for the recommended level is 16 gigabytes, which can be concerning for what is actually such a visually simplistic game. Now, there's a lot more behind which version of the game you're working with one version being only 2 gigabytes, but this does represent a shift that might indicate a push at a time when a lot of people don't want to put a lot more money into computers due to this dramatic, drastic pricing shift. It's been quite a while since a gaming push launched increases in computing power like this. And I think we're going to have to wait and see to if others are going to follow suit, pushing the RAM crisis into another whole level, much like we did back in the 90s and the aughts, when those were the big drivers for new hardware. Oh, this new game came out, I got to get a better video card. This new game came out, I got to get an even better video card. Things like that. When coming to the United States, there's a possibility that border agents may seek to scan your computing devices for illegal information. This has been a long-standing item and has been held up in courts many times. In January 2025, Samuel Tunick was returning from the Dominican Republic when Border Patrol asked him for his PIN code. He provided a special code for his phone that actually completely wiped the data. He's now facing federal charges that cover destruction of property to prevent seizure. This is akin to many other laws against destroying evidence, and yet it is the first legal fight against this particular technical feature. There's a lot behind this, and it's part of something I was trained on, the international movement of certain otherwise legal data, so I think he's likely to lose, and rightly so. I do value privacy, but his actions are really suspect. Coming up next, Allison's question: how do digital forensics teams recover data from drives? Here on Computer Talk Radio.
Let's talk about on and off.
You mean like light switches?
Yeah, the original user interface device.
And you were there, right?
Hey, I'm not that old.
Yeah, you are. So on and off.
Yeah, only with no humans doing it, like...
But you and I both have our computers on CyberPower UPS systems.
Yeah, so we have power, but there's another on and off.
Oh, right. Online and offline.
You got it. Meaning another UPS at the cable modem and VoIP phone and Wi-Fi router.
And even a low-cost standby UPS can handle those. Better, of course, if it has AVR.
Right, so it doesn't have to hit the battery just because the line voltage drops.
Maybe it's a good time to mention the promo that saves $10 to $15. Details are at the CyberPower website.
And maybe you could put it on your website?
Oh, that's already done at computertalkradio.com.
You know, on and off, you take really good care of your listeners.
Allison had a question for me. How do digital forensics teams recover data that someone tried to delete? You can reach out to me, of course, with your computer questions, your technology concerns, whatever they may be. The phone number, 888-NERD-888. That's 888-6373-888. Now, Allison's question comes out of some of the things we see on TV, but also in the movies and real life. And it's all about digital forensics and how do teams do that deep dive into a hard drive when sometimes it's something somebody tried to delete or perhaps it's a hard drive failure. And there's this part of technology that most people never see. We imagine deleting a file as kind of this digital vaporization. Poof, the file disappears into nothingness. But deleting a file is actually far less dramatic than people think. Most of the time, what's going on is when you delete a file, it's like removing a label from a box rather than destroying the box and all of its contents itself. The contents, everything there, actually sits quietly in the background until something comes along and overwrites that particular section of the drive. And that time gap between deletion and overwriting is where forensic teams do their work. Once you understand how storage systems, the hard drives and so forth, behave, it becomes clear why investigators can often recover things that were believed to be gone forever. So, this is just the first layer here. The deletion removes one thing, a pointer, not all of the content. So, when you delete a file, the operating system just goes in, Windows or Mac OS or whatever. They just say the space is available. It's just gone. And what it is they're just removing the file entry from the directory. All of the bits and bytes remain on the drive, and this is intentional. Fully erasing all of that file every time would slow down the system. So it's treated like a quick bookkeeping update, if you will. Forensics tools scan the raw storage blocks directly. So what they're doing is they're looking for the remnants of files that no longer appear in the file system. They scan the entire drive going through and they say, oh, this looks like a Word document. Let's see if there's an entry. No, there's no entry. They might even see like that bookkeeping and that entry is still there, but it has that bookkeeping check mark that says this file is no longer around. I mean, you can use that hard drive space. So we can recover that file just by enabling that bookkeeping update and saying, this file still exists. We still need this. And it's simple. It's something I've used this. There's a software tool called Recuva, R-E-C-U-V-A. And I've used this a number of times to go out and find files that I thought were gone or that I accidentally deleted or whatever. Even if the file name and location are gone, though, the underlying data is still there, and it may remain intact enough to reconstruct. So a simple deletion is not secure deletion. It's a convenience, not destruction. So the forensic teams, they also rely on metadata and fragments, and the fact that storage systems leave behind more clues than any of us would ever expect. See, many devices keep multiple copies of data for reliability. There's snapshots and caches and temporary files, and these can all contain older versions of the deleted content. You've got a Word document, and it may have a number of different copies of that file all sitting there on the drive, and all you need to do is just recover one of those. Applications also store their own backups. Messaging apps and photo editors and document tools may leave behind thumbnails or previews or autosave files. You've got autosave turned on in Microsoft Office. Well, it's saving a lot of copies of the file. And the file systems also maintain logs of changes. And these logs can reveal what was deleted, when it was deleted, and sometimes even partial content. And the neat thing in the forensics world is that fragmented data can still be very useful. We can stitch together pieces of files scattered across the drive. And this is because our modern storage systems prioritize resilience. They preserve more than we ever realize, which becomes a rich source of evidence. This also allows us to do a recovery of a hard drive. Oh, my drive failed. So you send it on into a company, and they can recover almost all of the data. Last time I did this was, 10 years ago, and it set me back a good, I think it was $1,200 at that time. It might be a little bit more these days. But they've got all kinds of different tools that can read the raw sectors from that hard drive, from the solid state drives, from memory cards, and they ignore, these tools just ignore any kind of file system's interpretation of the data. Now, yes, there are some crazier things that on a far more expensive level that forensics technicians can go through. Physical old rotating memory hard drives can leave magnetic traces even after data is overwritten once. Multiple overwrites are needed to fully eliminate all of those remnants. Now, solid state drives, they work in a memory fashion, but they can also leave behind various artifacts. Wear leveling moves data around, and it may actually create copies that persist longer than expected. Forensic imaging creates a bit-for-bit clone of the entire drive, and it allows the investigators to analyze it without altering the original evidence. I've had a chance to experiment around with some of these and work with them. And these tools are absolutely amazing. And sometimes they'll use pattern recognition to identify the file types based on the structure, even when the headers are missing. And they'll go through and they'll recover different portions. And that can be invaluable, both in the investigative process as well as the recovery process. And yes, even in cases where there's corruption or physical damage, specialists can go through and they can repair or bypass some of these different broken components to access all of that underlying data that we really value. This question from Allison is a reminder that deletion is kind of a suggestion to Windows or the Mac operating system or whatever. True erasure requires intentional steps. And forensic teams are actually even trained to find the traces left behind when those steps are taken or if they're not taken. So yeah, they can recover hard drives pretty well. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. MicroCenter is where tomorrow's tech meets today's hands-on excitement. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I've been shopping MicroCenter for years because they always have what's next. Whether you're building a custom desktop, upgrading your laptop, or diving into smart home automation, MicroCenter has the gear, the guidance, and the grit to get you there. From high-performance laptops and ultra-fast storage to 3D printers, robotics kits, and pro-grade monitors, it's all under one roof. Need help? Their in-store experts speak your language, whether that's HDMI, USB-C, or I just want it to work. With over 20 locations nationwide and MicroCenter.com open 24/7, you're never far from your next breakthrough. Whether you're a weekend tinkerer, a creative pro, or just tech curious, MicroCenter is your launchpad. Visit MicroCenter.com today. That's MicroCenter, built for what's next. MicroCenter.com. The phone number 888-NERD-888. That's 888-6373-888. If I don't answer the phone, which is most likely, please do leave a message. I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns. Keith M. Cedor joins me now. And Keith, one of the interesting things that came out this last week was Apple's what are they calling this? It's the Apple.
Used to be called the iPhone Upgrade Program.
Okay, so
now
I was.
Is the Apple Upgrade Program.
I was going to say Apple Upgrade, but it was sticking in my brain. I'm like, it doesn't sound like an upgrade, but then yes, okay, I see where we're going with this. Okay, so give everybody the rundown.
Simple change in nomenclature.
Yeah. So give everybody the rundown.
Well, basically, Benjamin, as you know, due to supply chain changes and chip constraints, Apple said they're going to raise the prices on devices across the board.
Yeah.
And what has happened is there was fear, and the market saw it immediately. There was fear that that was going to tank Apple stock prices because people were going to stop buying things. But the reality of it is Apple said, well, we've been leasing iPhones and subsidizing iPhones for all these years. Why not do the same with other Apple devices? So now you can get a Mac, whether it's a MacBook or an iMac, or you can get an iPad, or you can get an Apple Watch as a leased product from Apple.
Yeah. So give me the rundown. What are some of the different points here that we're talking about? How much per month are we considering?
Well, the first thing that I wanted to do, Benjamin, was to put it in the context of how I might use this. Because I, as an Apple-certified consultant, do like to get a new MacBook every X number of years. I'm not averse to keeping a machine for a long time. But I also like to have something fairly current that I can run the latest operating system on. And because of that, I need to get the biggest and the best. So I do a custom order from Apple. And the MacBook Pro, which is what I've traditionally had, would usually cap out somewhere around $34.99. This is when we've joked slash made fun of and ridiculed over the last couple of years. The highest MacBook Pro you can now buy now crosses the $10,000 barrier. And
yeah,
it's not really something I need. So I configured a MacBook Air with the maximum amount of RAM, which would be 32 gigabytes, and the maximum amount of storage, which would be 4 terabytes, which is nice because Apple bumped that up from a cap of 2 terabytes last year to now 4 terabytes. And that machine still tops out at $37.19. So that is really expensive for a MacBook Air, even with those specifications. So I wonder, would it be cool to lease it? So Apple had their site go active this week with leasing options. And when I put in all of those same configurations, 32 gigs, 4 terabytes of storage, I came up with a device that I could lease for either 24 months for $113 and change a month, or 36 months for about $79 a month. And what's interesting about that, Benjamin, is that I normally advocate keeping a Mac for about 5+ years, depending upon your budget.
Yeah.
And so if I'm going to pay that kind of money, and it gives me the option of paying it out at the end, and it didn't show me what the payout would be yet. I think you got to go deeper into the process, but preliminarily you could give it back at the end of the lease term and then just get the next new thing for a comparable monthly payment, or you can just be done with it. So, and, you know,
so
you decide.
So when was the payoff amount, basically, just presuming that, on the monthly payments, does it work out to roughly that 36-month time frame is when you've fully paid for the unit anyway?
I think so. I'm not 100% sure. I can tell you from past experience from business clients who have purchased, who have leased their Macs, the way those have been structured previously is that they would break it down for X number of months, and then they'd have a $1 buyout at the end of the lease term. And I'm wondering if that's what Apple is doing here. They didn't really go into the weeds on the what happens end of term, other than to say that you can buy it out or you could give it back.
So there is some need for anybody looking down this road to do the deep dive into the full math, to figure out what your out-of-pocket expense is and figure out if you are going to definitely be replacing at that 3-year mark. For me, I'm starting to think about the options for the next iPhone, if I'm going to go that route or doing the battery upgrade, which you and I talked about last week.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that I've had this one now for nearly 4 years, this mm-hmm. iPhone. Yeah, and I know you're in a similar spot 3 years in. And I know the phone is a 2-year plan, isn't it? It's 24
months. It is. I mean, most of the major carriers, Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, tout a new every 2 plan. And I myself have gone beyond that. I'm on the 15 Pro Max for the last, the 18s will be out in just a few months, so almost 3 years. And prior to that, that was upgraded from a 10S Max, which was 5 years before that.
Sure.
So, yeah, I've really tried to stretch and get my money's worth out of my iPhones, but there are still a lot of incentives. I'll give you a really good example, because my daughter, who is 16, wanted an upgrade from her iPhone 13 for her birthday, and we got her the iPhone 17 Pro, so now she now has the newest phone in the house.
Yeah.
But Verizon gave us $830 back for trading in her iPhone 13.
So
quite the incentive there to get rid of it.
It's not quite a break even on the trade-in. It is a big chunk of change now. And
the only thing that's really required of the user is that you maintain your relationship with that network.
Yeah, that is a distinct item to be looking at. And unfortunately, of course, in the computer space, not so much in the regular Macs. Do they do trade-ins on the iPads? Do you know?
There is on Apple's website a selection where you can say trade in a previous iPad, but I think it has to be a not too old iPad.
One of two things will happen. Space, yeah.
They will give you a pittance of an upgrade cost, for the trade-in. You know, it could be like $160 or less.
$12.
Something egregiously low, where it's like, I might as well just deal with the crazy people on Facebook Marketplace for the, if I want real money for it. Or you'll click on it and they'll say, hey, let us help you recycle that old device, which is their way of saying we're not giving you anything for it.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll take it off your hands for you and resell it and tell you you recycled it.
Yeah. So. I am mildly cynical about everything.
I think we've earned it.
But the iPhone portion, the trade-in, like you mentioned, with Verizon and I think AT&T and T-Mobile all have this same kind of arrangement. Apple announced that, was that at WWDC or was that like a year ago? I can't remember.
I'm hard-pressed to remember when it was announced, but they've had a number of things that incentivize people to stay on the network. And it's like, well, you stick with us, we'll keep giving you the new stuff.
Yeah, and Apple helped with that. They were the ones who announced it. So as for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell.
And I'm Keith M. Cedor.
You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Most of us use digital cameras nowadays, but what do we do with those old pictures and slides in the back of the closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. If you have boxes of old slides, then you know they fade more and more each year. Let Legacy Digital scan them for you and stop the aging process dead in its tracks. You'll get beautiful 10-megapixel digital files, color-corrected and ready for printing. All this is done faster and cheaper than buying a film scanner and doing it yourself. Your files are then burned onto gold archival DVD discs where they will last for generations. Call right now, mention my name, Benjamin Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY. And tell them Benjamin sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
The website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. That is one of the ways that you can reach out to us. Of course, scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I'll get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns. We also have the podcast there and our news items and a few other things. Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, we recently talked about Copilot, but you've tinkered with some of the others. I know you've dropped Gemini a couple of times in our conversations.
Gemini is one of my most recent encounters.
Okay.
And as you know, I've gone through ChatGPT, I've gone through Copilot, I've gone through Claude. I'm into Perplexity sometime, mm-hmm. and I thought, well, you know, Copilot's right there, might as well give it a shot. Gemini, I have to say, I've been trying it, and it is an undisciplined chatterbox.
Okay.
It has no compunction at all, no hesitation when it comes to ignoring or violating instructions.
Okay.
It jumps to conclusions instead of asking what you want. It always, always has a follow-up question to keep you burning tokens longer.
Uh-huh.
It keeps requesting documents. You have a document. You have a document, right? So it can auto-gen recaps. Well, I already know what's in the document.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't need your recap of it. Oh, gee, you can read and recite. Oh, boy, I got a parrot when I was a kid.
but in all fairness, what you've just described sounds like a lot of what we're dealing with all of the LLMs, all of the AI platforms out there.
But the other ones are easier to tame.
Okay, so this one's above and beyond those.
It's a bad dog.
You've got a bunch of annoying ones, and this is the most annoying one of them. Okay.
Yeah. It also will do compromised work on the excuse that there's some kind of limitation while performing the thing that I just asked it to do.
Yeah.
And if you left something that it's able to assume, it will assume it. It won't ask.
All right.
It'll just assume.
Oh, wow.
Now, here's what's especially edifying.
Yes.
And everybody out there, you've got access to free versions of almost every AI.
Yeah.
So I took a Gemini exploration. I picked a topic. I made it go deep. I made it go wide. And I took the entire text of the session.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And conversations, if you can call it that, because Gemini seldom leans into brevity. Through Android Auto when driving are a lot like listening to a radio talk show with a host who wants to sound smarter than he really is. You've got the opposite here, folks. You've got a guy who really is smart and you know, he speaks fluent English and ancient geek and nerd Vijian. We've talked about that before.
Yes.
But I took a whole Gemini exploration, copied it, and pasted it into Claude.
Yeah.
And I said, look, any comments, any corrections, anything at all? Wow.
Yes.
Gemini got a lot of stuff wrong. It identified people as doing things they were no longer doing. Mm-hmm. Things that stated as factual or current were just wow, off the mark.
Yes.
And its analyses were not.
Okay. All right.
Gemini, I go to every once in a while to amuse myself mm-hmm. because it's the only one of the group that I can talk to through Android Auto.
Yeah.
But okay. There's almost never anything of consequence that I can learn that way.
Wow. That's unfortunate. So you gave me a phrase offline a little while, an alternative for artificial intelligence.
Artificial ignorance.
I think you said advanced ignorance. Advanced yes, ignorance. Yes.
I'm sorry, yeah.
Oh, man. This is, so I know this is a snapshot in time right now. Of the platforms you've worked with, you're working with, what would you say is the one that is
clearly the best?
Yeah.
Is Claude.
Okay.
And its more advanced modes are fully worth the tokens. And within Claude, there's a facility that I bring to everyone's attention called Projects.
Okay.
You can attach chats to projects.
Mm-hmm.
Projects can retain files and instructions from previous chats.
Okay. Or
you can independently load them.
Okay.
So I have one particular project that has scores of files.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I open up a new chat, I don't have to start from scratch.
Okay.
In fact, I also put in a README first file to tell it where to go to catch up on stuff and an up file that instructs it to read the README first file. So all I have to do when I go into a chat is say, read up.
Okay. There you go. That kind of catches it up to date and holds it to a higher standard.
And we're not starting from scratch.
That is that's nice. I've poked at it in the past. I need to go and poke at it again some more, I guess.
I think you do. And we'll change its name to Pokey for you.
There we go. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and just a normal person. Recently, though, it was clear to me that it was time to upgrade. But I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After searching around for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when a 32-ounce soda would do. These guys know WordPress, Joomla, and regular standard websites. These guys at SiteGround are awesome. SiteGround.com. Site, S-I-T-E, ground.com. The bad guys are out to get us. They're out to get you, me, and everybody they can. And they have all kinds of tricks up their sleeves, of course. And I received an email. And this email purportedly came from crypto.com. I'm not a customer of theirs, so I should just ignore this. And this is something I would always suggest. If you're not a customer of someplace, don't even bother with answering the email or even looking at it. But it asks me to authorize a login from a new device. New login detected. A new login attempt has been detected on your account. Please review the login details below. All right. And then it gives an IP address, and it says it's in Mumbai, India, and it says it's on a Samsung S21 Ultra. Okay, whatever. If you do not recognize this login attempt, please contact our customer support team immediately. Huh, that's odd. Usually they say if you don't recognize it, just ignore this message. We'll lock them out. But instead, what they want me to do, they've given instructions. Identity synchronization to resolve the administrative lock. Okay, so they locked it down. All right. You must follow the live instructions provided by our support service. Then there's a verification protocol. Our security specialist will guide you through the mandatory identity confirmation process to secure your 12-word recovery phrase. This is what they do over in the crypto world. Not crypto.com, but just the Bitcoin and all of these different places. You have a special phrase that locks down your digital money. Access restoration. Stay connected with the support line until the support ID CDC is marked as resolved. I changed the numbers a little bit, but there you go. You've got the idea there. What they're doing is they're looking for me to call immediately, and then I've got to follow whatever instructions they give. And those instructions may involve installing a software. I didn't chase this down. They may involve my going and logging in to crypto.com and changing stuff so they have access to, yes, the entire whatever I've got over there at crypto.com, which I don't, and so forth. And there's a mandatory identity confirmation process. And that'll probably be something where I'm going to enter it in and they're going to ask me to verify those words and jump through whatever hoops where they get the access to my information that's stored at that location. And I've got to stay on the line. I have to stay connected until it's marked as resolved. Otherwise, there's going to be a problem. And this is building up the expectations that I can't hang up on them. I have to follow all of these instructions, no matter how daunting or scary these instructions may sound. This is the only way to protect whatever digital currency I have. It is building on my fears. It's building up the trust here that I must give to somebody that I'm calling wherever else it is. And a side note, I looked up the IP address, and that IP address doesn't go to Mumbai, India. Instead, it goes to Tehran, Iran. Yes, that's right. Yeah, what are we going to do? This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Coming up next is a really funny guy. You all know him. Let's give it up for Alonzo Bowden. Alonzo!
So my uncle calls and he says he's dizzy and he's losing his balance. I'm like, Unc, you want me to take you to a doctor? He's like, no, I'm going to look up the symptoms. I said, your symptoms are you're dizzy and you're losing your balance. So he said, I can't get on the internet because my arm is numb. I said, well, use your good arm and dial 911.
Stroke's no joke. If you or someone you love is showing symptoms of stroke, don't call family, don't dial a friend, don't wait because it might be too late. Dial 911. Time lost is brain lost. Seriously, dial 911.
Learn all the symptoms of a stroke at strokesnojoke.org. That's strokesnojoke.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Laptops, thumb drives, and a wall charger. A sure sign that our nerd is here again. Bringing you the latest in computers and gadgetry, here's Benjamin Rockwell with Computer Talk Radio.
The website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. That's just one of the ways to reach out to us. You scroll down to where it says Contact Us Today and fill out the form there. You can also find the podcast there, and you can see all of the news items that I cover here on the show. The phone number, 888-NERD, 888. That's 888-637-3888. Leave a message, and I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Steve Keske.
Who?
I'm sorry?
Old or new?
Old or new questions?
Yeah.
Okay, sure. That's the voice of Steve Keske. And I understand you've got a question from one of the audience.
Right. Susie wrote me and asked me a philosophical type question.
Okay.
And it is, do you think humanity will ever run out of high-tech questions to answer?
Wow. Okay. So, yeah, that definitely has a philosophical bent to it. We have to, a futurist look. We have to kind of think ahead through all of the different things that we've seen, of course, across the years, across our past, and how do they impact the future? So what is your first gut feel on that?
No, we won't.
You give the future generations a lot of credit on this one.
No, it's the idea that humanity itself will never stop asking questions.
And actually,
period.
I agree with you on that one. I couldn't disagree with you at all on this. When you ponder how many questions people are asking. All of the different AI platforms, whether it's Claude or ChatGPT or Gemini or whatever, we have always questioned. We have always pondered. And I think that is one of the defining factors that AI is not going to be able to achieve any time in the near future. The random questions that we seek to learn more, we seek to find new ways to go, we explore. And while it can be trained to explore, to ask questions, AI is a long ways off with that.
Well, it's not just that. It's that you and I and a lot of other people have an imagination.
Yes.
And putting,
indeed,
trying to put an imagination into a computer or AI ain't going to happen very soon.
Yeah. Well, it requires abstract thought. It requires daydreaming. It requires so many different aspects that are out there. It also requires a certain ego level that AI is also not capable of.
No, it
thinks it knows everything. It thinks it is absolutely superior to all of us, even though it has no idea where it actually sits on the intelligence. Well, not intelligence. EQ, the emotional quotient,
right,
level.
And to me, it's a simple situation where every time you answer a question, 2 to 3 more questions always pop up.
Sure.
So it's just that kind of a situation that mankind has gone through for the last few millennium.
Yes.
Or more.
Yes.
And will keep doing, especially if we ever get off this planet.
Yes. Well, you know, we have arrived at this point, this day specifically.
Yep.
And we will arrive at, the day tomorrow and beyond because we have been asking questions. And not only that, we've been seeking to improve ourselves and the world around us. That is what technology is at its core, making life easier for us, improving our lives, making things so much better.
That's a very broad statement.
It is, and I recognize it. But if you think of, I mean, you and I have had this conversation before, all of the different things that we think of as technology and technology drivers and all of that. Usually when you and I talk about these, we are talking about things that are far earlier than what most people think about.
Well,
you know, you ask somebody what they think a computer is, and they will give you a definition of what a computer is today. They aren't going to think about the idea that at some point in time we had floppy disks, or before that, cassette tapes, or before that, the big, huge reels on the mainframes, or before that, the punch cards that you used, and before that, just manually entering in using toggle switches and quarter-inch plugs and jacks.
Yep.
So, you know, all the way along, all of these different improvements and what we think of as computers, what we think of as smartphones. Everybody thinks a smartphone is the latest version of the Samsung or the iPhone. But smartphones actually existed prior to the iPhone. They were simply phones that connected to the internet and had a few of the features that the iPhone had.
Yep. But, you know, what to me is very intuitive about what you specifically stated.
Yes.
About what a computer is.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to you, and I'm saying I lived through that.
Yeah, and that, and that, and that, and that, that, yeah.
You know?
The only thing out of that list, by the way, the only thing that I actually did not personally encounter,
yep,
was the punch cards themselves. I've never, I did the, you know, fill in the dots, you know, tests that were similar to the punch cards, but I never actually programmed a computer with a punch card.
Did you ever use a plug board?
Yes, back in very early days, and it wasn't so much computing as it was just simple assembly of electronics. So
in this case,
yeah,
you know, that's one way, that's one kind of a plug board.
Yeah.
The one I had you plugged a one end of your wire over here.
Yeah.
And then you plugged the other end over there.
Yeah.
So that it created a circuit so that when you run the cards through, it does certain calculation.
Sure. Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. I not one of those. The closest I did was, yeah, just general electronic circuitry. Yeah. So many things, and I think we are going to continue asking questions in any kind of foreseeable future. I don't see AI in our lifetimes achieving being able to ask questions more thoroughly than we do. And that's kind of, and when I say our lifetime, I'm referring to you, me, and also all of our listeners, whatever age they may be. So Anyways, as for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That is Steve Keske. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. You have a couple of those new carbon open frame racks from CyberPower, right?
Yeah, I love them. I configured a 25U to 40 inches deep, about twice as deep as a regular rack, and put more than a dozen peripherals in it.
You know, I saw your article about it. I can't believe it's not clutter.
And my 45U carbon rack, that's also 40 inches deep, will hold a ton of networking and control systems, the network video recorder.
Holy screwdriver, rack man!
You're getting one of their gorgeous enclosed racks soon.
Oh yeah, the 24U. Bigger than their wall mount carbon racks, but smaller than their tall boy.
Did you see what's happening with carbon on the CyberPower website?
Oh yeah, the promo, 10% off all their racks and rack accessories through the end of September. I put a link up at computertalkradio.com. computertalkradio.com. The website, computertalkradio.com, computertalkradio.com. Reach out to me, scroll down to where it says contact us today, and you can send me your messages, ideas for topics, or questions about your computer, your technology concerns, whatever they may be, and I will get back with you. Dr. Doreen Galley joins me now, and you've got another series of whisper reports you're going to be covering here. And, of course, you've been doing this recently. Open up. Tell us where we can find these whisper reports.
Absolutely. So we have TBW 2191, 2108, and TBW 2132. It's at tbwadvisors.com/ and the TBW 4-digit code. So that's T for technical, B for business, and W for whispers.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one, 2191, is actually from Informatica World. We have Accenture, Insep Data Solutions, Informatica themselves, and Cognizant.
Okay.
And the question was, what data problem slows AI adoption the most?
Okay, all right.
This was Informatica World, so these are the really
these are the big number crunchers, data crunchers. Yes,
these are the real data people that have been doing data management, integration, and everything to do with data their entire career for decades. And it's the stuff that people like to ignore and think you can just get AI, but you actually can't do any AI without it.
Yes, indeed.
So the first point was made by Accenture, and it's like, trust is the prerequisite. Let's just get that off, right? If people don't trust the data, it doesn't matter what tool you put on it. No one's going to use the tool.
Very true. Yeah.
If they don't trust it, they don't use it. Your adoption is pretty slow.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Pretty straightforward. The second one was on standardization gaps, right? And so a lot of times the data isn't standardized. And so when you try to integrate it and you get the right data at the right place, you can put the components together. One's in centimeters and one's in inches.
Sure. Or date formats is another one that I see all the time. Somebody stores it in this date, in the American date format. There's the European date format. There's somebody just made up one. It's like,
in money,
the
periods and commas swapped between Europe and the U.S.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And so you have to have the right data, and data quality. It has to be standardized and clean so that you can actually use it to do the math, because AI is math.
Yeah.
And you need your data clean. And then the one of my favorite quotes was from Informatica's Sumeet Aggarwal, where he says, people believe you can put garbage in and magically get gospel out. But if you didn't clean and standardize your data before you put into the AI system, you're not getting gospel out. You're getting beyond hallucinations and junk.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And that was Informatica's Sumit Agarwal. It was a great quote. And then the final thing was all about governance. You know, you really have to govern. You have to make sure you know what it is, who's allowed to do it, and so on, to make sure that you can rely and count on it.
Yes.
The second was Freeport. Was from G2E, the gaming expo, and it was talk about risks in iGaming, which is online gaming, and one of the biggest risks to the industry is that people can't integrate their components, mm-hmm. and so yeah. you know, people in the industry are trying to grow, but nothing's standardized. And we had mentioned this before in the when we covered the casinos in general, that there's so much money there that they keep getting sold custom solutions to each of the individual casinos.
Yeah.
And nothing's standardized. So these sure. poor vendors working between them, it's an utter nightmare. Fraud, obviously, when it's remote as opposed to in person, there's yeah. more fraud. Yeah. The other problem is that if they're not actually supporting responsible gaming, then they're at risk for increased regulatory. And so yes, one of the people yes. said to all is like, make sure we're fair and good by our players and, you know, watch out so they don't develop problems. Otherwise, people will come tell us what to do and make sure we're not creating problems for
yes,
people.
Yes, yes.
And so that self-awareness, admittedly, I thought was kind of nice. And then the third report.
Yeah.
We're going back to spatial computing. Remember, spatial computing is another word for extended reality. It defines the science mm-hmm, of mm-hmm. all of these extended realities, augmented reality, mixed reality, virtual reality, any and all of this neat, cool tech where it becomes 3D or imaginary yeah, 100% yeah, or yeah. you're interacting with it virtual. That is in the fundamental speed of spatial computing, which we covered a lot of it at CES. We also see it at SEMA and Apex. We see it somewhat in Hollywood and NAB coverage. So we sure, see it yeah. across the industries. And this question was, which spatial computing use case is going to scale the fastest?
Ooh, okay. I like that one. All right, go on.
Yeah, yeah.
So what were their responses?
We have Perfect Core, Happily, DSpace, and Israel Railways. Perfect Core gave the answer on APIs. Now, to understand why he says this, they have AI tech that is used to help people pick out their makeup, their clothes, and their hair.
Okay.
As well as healthcare in the medical field, including dermatology.
Okay. All right.
Talk about enablement to scale fastest. His APIs allowed him to completely, deeply penetrate two different industries, both with a lot of revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And get qualified.
I like that. So basically, they're talking about now I don't wear makeup and I don't even have a hairstyle. But a matter of, okay, I do have a dermatology issue. So they could probably utilize that to map out my skin and say, okay, we need to smooth it here and get into fine, right. refined things instead of, you know, just putting a whole bunch of right. gunk on my face. So,
it depends on what specialty small AI algorithms use around it. Most sure. solutions are never one AI machine learning.
Okay.
Problem. There are a yeah. lot of models yeah. put together to solve it. And so part of it has to do like Legos.
Yeah.
Ones you put together. Haptic interfaces. We've heard from Happily with haptic interfaces. Obviously, when you can touch and feel things. Digital twins was from DSpace. Digital twins is when you have a complete digital replication. So for the digital twin, you simulate the actual air tunnel to wind test a car
okay.
instead of building the model and throwing it in a wind tunnel. To use the model electronically is significantly cheaper and faster than creating the materials and having to wind tunnel in real life.
Okay.
As an example. So digital twins are fantastic, great use case. And then Israel Railways was all about getting all the right people together in an area where you have all the startups so they can collaborate and interrelate, and together they innovate together. So the five startups create one beautiful solution.
Very cool. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell.
And Dr. Doreen Galley.
You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. MicroCenter is where tomorrow's tech meets today's hands-on excitement. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I've been shopping MicroCenter for years because they always have what's next. Whether you're building a custom desktop, upgrading your laptop, or diving into smart home automation, MicroCenter has the gear, the guidance, and the grit to get you there. From high-performance laptops and ultra-fast storage to 3D printers, robotics kits, and pro-grade monitors, it's all under one roof. Need help? Their in-store experts speak your language, whether that's HDMI, USB-C, or I just want it to work. With over 20 locations nationwide and microcenter.com open 24/7, you're never far from your next breakthrough. Whether you're a weekend tinkerer, a creative pro, or just tech curious, MicroCenter is your launchpad. Visit microcenter.com today. That's MicroCenter, built for what's next. MicroCenter.com. If you have an idea for a topic on the show, feel free to reach out to me at ComputerTalkRadio.com. Scroll down to where it says Contact Us Today, and I will expound on whatever tech topic you would like. In this case, a friend of mine, Chris, made a comment, and I started to think about it, and I said, this really deserves a topic. For ages, the advice that we received growing up was simple. Don't always believe what you hear. This was a simple reminder that rumors travel faster than facts, and that spoken words can be twisted long before they reach our ears. It's a warning that is rooted in human nature. And over the course of time, we saw new things. We had one idea that came forward. It was a very clever marketing where a product came out and it proudly declared you couldn't believe what you tasted. I can't believe it's not butter was funny at first, but that really changed how we think about these things. It showed that even our taste could be manipulated for convenience, at least a little bit. It's still not quite butter, but the internet, of course, arrived and the warning changed yet again. Don't always believe what you read on the internet. And that was then shortened to don't always believe what you read. Every headline, every comment, every Reddit post, forwarded message had to be filtered through a certain level of skepticism, and the written word lost some of its credibility there. We now have a new frontier ahead of us, AI, and we have AI-generated images and videos and voices and text and all of the rest of it, and we can no longer believe what we see. Vision. The sense we trusted most is now the easiest one to fool. A picture is no longer proof. A video is no longer evidence. I have seen all kinds of very realistic pictures that were photoshopped or AI-driven or videos that purport to be outlandish things, and you go, that can't be real. This is a downhill road, and it's getting steeper. The road just keeps dipping further and further down. When hearing, tasting, reading, and seeing can all be manipulated, we are left wondering what remains. What sense can we actually trust? What signal cuts through the noise? The problem isn't that fakes exist. It is now that they are potentially indistinguishable from reality. AI can generate a face that never existed. It can create a voice very much like your friends, your neighbors, your family members that actually never existed, and moments that never happened. And it can do it in a little bit of time and tokens, of course. We used to rely on our senses to hold us down, to anchor us. And if you saw it with your own eyes, that was the end of the debate. If you heard it yourself, that settled the argument. But those anchors are slipping, and the water is getting rough. The erosion of sensory trust has consequences far beyond entertainment. It affects journalism and justice, politics, education, everyday relationships. When truth becomes negotiable, everything becomes vulnerable. We are entering into a world where evidence can be manufactured, where memories can be simulated, where everything can be forged and altered and manipulated in all kinds of different ways. And the average person has no way to tell the difference. The danger isn't just deception, it's exhaustion. When you and I can't tell what is real, we're going to stop trying. We're going to stop caring. We're going to stop believing anything. And that's a dangerous outcome. We've added in new things. We've got, forget reality. We now have virtual reality, expanded reality, augmented reality. And it's all going to drive us in directions that we can no longer trust our senses. And a society that can't trust its senses becomes a society that can't trust itself. Conversations become arguments, arguments become accusations, accusations become chaos, and all because the foundation of truth has cracked, is broken. Technology has always challenged our assumptions. This is different. This is not a new gadget or new platform. This is a direct attack on the way humans perceive reality. It's a shift at the sensory level. And once that shift happens, it's not going to go back. We are never going to again live in a world where seeing is believing. That era is gone. The question now is how we are going to adapt. We do need new tools to verify authenticity. We need new habits to question what we encounter. We need new instincts to navigate a world where everything can be fake. We also need something deeper. We need to rebuild trust in ways that do not rely on sensory input. We need to value things like consistency and context and credibility. We also need to ask who benefits from the illusion that's placed in front of us. This is a rabbit hole. And the rabbit hole doesn't end with fake images. It doesn't end with fake videos. It goes into the fake voices, fake documents, fake conversations, and yeah, sadly, fake people. It goes into systems that impersonate anyone at any time for any reason. And if we don't confront that reality right now, we risk losing the ability to distinguish truth from the noise, from fact into fiction. We risk losing the ability to make decisions based on facts. We risk losing the shared reality that holds our society all together. Don't get me wrong. Some of these things are cool that we're doing, but are we doing them for the right reason? Are we really applying good morals and ethics and scruples to our daily interactions with tech? This is, I feel like this is a turning point, that we have drifted in a direction where this is inescapable, and we are going to wind up just absolutely fooling others, ourselves, and I mean this as a society where The future is not going to be about believing what you hear, taste, read, or see. It's going to be about understanding the forces behind what is presented to you. And that is a harder thing to do. We don't always understand some of these things. And yes, everybody, there's millions of people using Facebook and they don't understand the forces behind Facebook, what it's doing to us and all of that. But we need to start questioning. We need to be questioning the source, not what it is feeding our senses. In a world where everything can be faked, the only thing that matters is the integrity of the person delivering the message. And that is where truth is going to have to live from now on. We're not really through this. We're not going to see what's on the other side until we start to learn to be discerning in all of the things we're dealing with. And along the way, we're not just losing trust in our senses. We're also going to be losing trust in the systems that feed them. And that is why this moment, this decision that you need to make, we need to make, to learn a little bit more about what's going on, this matters. Because once truth becomes optional, everything else becomes unstable. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Hey guys, this is Benny Rockwell. Most of us use video cameras nowadays, but what about those old movie films in the back of your closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. Imagine grandpa's old 8mm and 16mm films that are just sitting in a box getting old and fading away. Legacy Digital will clean and recondition those films, capture them digitally frame by frame, and then produce beautiful DVDs of your precious memories on long-lasting archive-quality discs. They don't use a projector, and your films can't be damaged in the process, the best available for families like yours. The final results are gorgeous. What better way to preserve those precious memories for future generations? Call right now, mention my name, Benny Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY, 1-866-253-4229. And tell them Benny sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and a lot of the ways that these all intertwine. A lot of people assume that connecting every system in the workplace will make everything smoother. This idea sounds reasonable. If the tools talk to each other, the work should flow without interruption. I will say, though, when you start to look closer, all of these pictures of beautiful flowers just change. The more connections that a workflow has, actually, the more fragile it becomes. One small delay in a single system in all of these interconnected workflows can actually ripple along and slow everything else down. A simple login issue on one tool can stall a task that three others depend on. You can see this when a team over here tries to update a record on one platform, only to discover that the update depends on a synchronization that hasn't run yet. The work pauses, not because the task is complicated, but because all of the chains, these different fingers in between the systems, all behind the scenes, are taking longer than anyone realized. And even routine actions can get tangled here. A request that might take a few minutes now could wait for approvals and background checks or automated steps that are run in a very specific order. The workflow looks modern because it's a newer system, it's a newer integration and all of this, but it moves with less freedom. In many workplaces, this doesn't feel dramatic. It's going to be in a much more subtle form. You'll see forms that are loading slower or a synchronization that takes longer than expected. We might see a situation where a notification will arrive later than we expect, and we need to then go address the notification and then all of the things that we did before that. Now, none of this feels like a failure, but each moment happens to chip away at momentum. Teams will feel the strain when they try to move quickly. There will be a fast-paced group over here that will hit a wall when the system insists on a sequence that doesn't match how they think. They wait for steps that used to be instant. Now they adjust, but the adjustment becomes part of the work. The complexity grows quietly. A new integration gets added, then another and another and another, and all of these really make sense on their own, but together they start to create mazes that no one can see from the outside. And then, when something breaks, the cause is no longer as obvious as it used to be. People will start to blame the tool that's in front of them, the one that they use, even though the real issue sits a number of steps away in a system they've never heard about, they don't touch, and it's used by another team altogether. Now, the workflow didn't fail, but all of the stuff behind the scenes did. The chain broke. Organizations that recognize this pattern start looking at their systems differently. Instead of asking, hey, how can we connect this all together? They ask where independence matters. They look for places where a task should stand on its own without waiting for all kinds of a chain of events to occur before they can proceed. Sometimes the fix is simple. A manual step that replaces an unreliable synchronization. A shortcut that bypasses a long sequence. These are small buffers here that can give people room to work without waiting for all of these complex intertwined systems to catch up. Sometimes the answer, however, should be to simplify the entire path. We should always be looking to remove steps that no longer serve a purpose. Why do we do it this way? Because we've always done it this way. Well, maybe we need to remove some of these steps that have no value. Maybe we can combine some actions that belong together. If somebody's taking down the payable information, who are we going to write the check to for this particular invoice that we've received? Maybe they should input all of the information on that invoice instead of passing that along to somebody else who enters in that portion and then passing that along over to somebody else who enters in the contract information. You know, it should be all in one spot. We need to be giving teams the tools that match the speed they need instead of the speed the system allows. When the workflow supports the natural pace of everyone using it, everything starts to feel easier. The technology all the way along here should be a partner instead of a gatekeeper. That's what technology is all about. It's about empowering us. And if we are empowered here, all of these chains become paths instead of traps. Connection is valuable, but only when it doesn't steal momentum. When companies design workflows and integrations and all of this together with the idea of potential independence where it matters, they create systems that move with the teams instead of against them. All of the work just becomes smoother. The delays will fade away. And the organization will build up a kind of quiet resilience that comes from not relying on a single perfect chain of events, a perfect network, a perfect everything all the way through. We need to be accounting for imperfections in all that we do because we're only human. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and, well, a normal person. Recently, though, it became clear to me that it was time to upgrade. I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost? It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After looking for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their care, their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when all I needed was a 1-gallon bucket. The folks at SiteGround know WordPress, Joomla, and more. SiteGround.com, S-I-T-E, ground.com for your web hosting needs. SiteGround. Jenna reached out to me. I'm getting emails that say my cloud storage is almost full, but I barely use it. What fills it up without me noticing? Now, this is a two-part thing. I've got to be very careful on this because there are currently a number of scams going around. And I want to caution everybody. What I'm going to talk about in regards to the fix is if you're dealing with truly your cloud storage company. Don't trust any of the emails that say, oh, your cloud storage is filling up. Click here and pay, you know, whatever. Give us your credit card number and all of that. Be careful about those. Make sure you're dealing with whoever it is, whether it's Apple iCloud or Dropbox or whoever. You're going to directly go through their app to do this. Now, what might actually be filling up cloud storage is another whole issue. It fills up quietly because we've got all of these different devices backing up things automatically, and it's your photos, your messages, email, app data settings, and they all sync in the background without anybody really realizing this. And these small items add up over time. And phones frequently will upload full resolution photos and videos to the cloud, and those files are really a lot larger than they look. You see a little image on your screen, but that image is actually large enough for you to go full screen on a big, huge monitor. They are high resolution. So just a short handful of video clips and pictures can take up a lot more space than you realize. And some of the apps that you're dealing with, they're going to store hidden backups. There are all kinds of different things, and it can be temporary files or thumbnails and chat histories or whatever it is. And you're never going to see them, but they count towards your storage limit just like anything else. Old device backups actually are one of the biggest culprits. If you've upgraded your phone or tablet, the cloud actually may be holding on to the backup of that previous device, quietly eating the space. And most of this storage isn't taken by things you didn't intentionally save. Automatic backups are the real space hogs. The easiest fix, you just need to figure out what your cloud storage breakdown is. Most of these services will show you a list of what's using space, and the biggest items usually stand out immediately. Seeing the categories helps you decide what's safe to remove. Oh, I haven't used that phone in ages. I can delete that backup. And that can be done without affecting your current phone. And that is probably one of the safest places to start, and that's usually one of the biggest, huge chunks. You can also turn off automatic uploads for apps you don't need syncing. This stops new files from piling up, and it keeps your storage from creeping towards that limit yet again. And if you want to keep everything but you need more room, you can download large items to your computer and store them locally. That is a trick I've used in the past to help keep my cloud tidy without losing anything important. I want you to think of cloud storage like a closet. It fills with things you forgot you put there, and clearing out all of that closet makes the whole space feel far more usable again. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. We'll catch you next week.
Coming up next is a really funny guy. You all know him. Let's give it up for Alonzo Bowden. Alonzo!
So my uncle calls and he says he's dizzy and he's losing his balance. I'm like, "Unc, you want me to take you to a doctor?" He's like, "No, I'm going to look up the symptoms." I said, "Your symptoms are you're dizzy and you're losing your balance." So he said, "I can't get on the internet because my arm is numb." I said, "Well, use your good arm and dial 911. Stroke's no joke. If you or someone you love is showing symptoms of stroke, don't call family, don't dial a friend. Don't wait, because it might be too late. Dial 911. Time lost is brain lost. Seriously, dial 911.
Learn all the symptoms of a stroke at StrokesNoJoke.org. That's StrokesNoJoke.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.